Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GS Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Any investments based on Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hi, everyone. This is Richard Martin here with your wake-up call. And it is almost certainly Monday, April the 20th, 2015, although I'm recording this on Saturday the 18th, and I am in Southeast Asia. Well, today's talk is going to be a very tough one. It can be considered your dress rehearsal for the great Greek earthquake, which is just around the corner. It is, in short, derivatives. Now, I've talked a lot about derivatives, and it's possible that the entire show will be about derivatives today because the Greek horror will be centered around the derivatives nightmare, and I want to be sure you have a front seat in terms of understanding what's going on. So we're going to start today with a fairly lengthy recap of what derivatives are all about. Yes, again. And then we'll move on to the Greek question and see how all your newfound knowledge applies there. Ready? Okay, so here we go. Let's start by having another look at precisely what derivatives are. Well, they can be immensely complicated, but I'm going to try to simplify things. On a very basic level, a derivative is actually not an investment in anything. When you buy a stock, you're purchasing an ownership interest in a company. When you buy a bond, you're purchasing the debt of a company. But a derivative is quite different. In essence, most derivatives are simply bets about what will or will not happen in the future. The big banks have transformed Wall Street into the biggest casino in the history of the planet. And when things are running smoothly, they usually make a whole lot of money. The very same people that caused the last economic crisis have created a $278 trillion derivatives time bomb that could go off at any moment. When this absolutely colossal bubble does implode, we are going to be faced with the worst economic crash in world history. During the last financial crisis, politicians promised us that they would make sure that too big to fail would never be a problem again. Instead, those banks have actually become far larger since then. So now we really can't afford them to fail. The six banks I'm talking about are JP Morgan Chase, Citibank, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, and Wells Fargo. When you add up all their exposure to derivatives, it comes to a grand total of more than $278 trillion. But when you add up all of the assets of all six banks combined, it only comes to a grand total of about $9.8 trillion. In other words, these too-big-to-fail banks have exposure to derivatives, that's, remember, bets, nothing more, nothing less, that is more than 28 times greater than their total assets. This, ladies and gentlemen, is complete and utter insanity. And yet nobody seems too alarmed about it. For the moment, those banks are still making lots of money, and funding the campaigns of most of your prominent politicians? Right now, there is no incentive for them to stop their incredibly reckless gambling, so they're just going to keep on doing it. But there is a fundamental flaw in the system. At this point, the five largest banks account for 42% of all loans in the United States, and the six largest banks account for 67% of all assets in the financial system. If someone came along and zapped those banks out of existence, the economy would totally collapse overnight. So the health of this handful of immensely powerful banking institutions is absolutely critical to the economy. But you see, these banks have become deeply addicted to gambling. In exactly the same way that people allow their lives to be destroyed by addictions that they can never shake, that is what is happening to these banks. They have transformed Wall Street into the largest casino in the history of the world. Most of the time, their bets pay off, and they make lots of money. But as we saw back in 2008, when they miscalculate, things can fall apart very rapidly. The bets that I am most concerned about are these famous derivatives. In essence, they are bets about what will or will not happen in the future. The big banks use these very sophisticated algorithms that are supposed to help them be on the winning side of these bets the vast majority of the time. But these algorithms are not perfect. The reason these algorithms are not perfect is that they're based on assumptions, and those assumptions come from people. They may be really smart people, but they're still just people. If things stay fairly stable like they have the past few years, the algorithms tend to work very well. But if there is a black swan event, such as a major stock market crash, a collapse of European or Asian banks, a historic shift in interest rates, an Ebola pandemic, a horrific natural disaster, or a massive EMP blast is unleashed by the sun, or, as I think we're about to see, a massive blow-up of Greece, which is why we're talking about this right now, everything can be suddenly thrown out of balance. Acrobat Nick Wallenda makes headlines all over the world for crossing vast distances on a high wire without a safety net. Well, that's essentially what the too big to fail banks are doing every single day. With each passing year, these banks have become even more reckless, and so far, there haven't been any serious consequences. But there soon will be. What would you say about a bookie that took $200,000 in bets, but that only had $10,000 to cover those bets? You'd certainly call that bookie a fool. But that is what the big banks are doing. Today, the too big to fail banks are being even more reckless than they were just prior to the financial crash of 2008. As long as they keep winning, everyone's going to be okay. But when the time comes that their bets start going against them, it's going to be a nightmare for all of us. Our entire economic system is based on the flow of credit, and those banks are at the very heart of that system. The trigger to the next crisis will not be the same as the trigger to the last one, but there will be another crisis. I think the pending Greek situation will be the defining event I've been preparing you for. This is something that I've been warning about for a long time. So, let's stop here for a few moments. I'll give you my information. You can get a coffee, and I'll have a swig of iced water. Then we'll keep going. Right? Well, if you want to write to me, if you would like to write a message for us all at the wake-up call, or a question, or a rant, or anything that tickles your fancy, just write to me at my email, rm@gfawd.com. That's again, rm for Richard Martin, @gfawd, and that stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, .com. So once again, that's rm@gfawd.com. And finally, my direct line, if any of you would like to call me in, I am pleased to note that several people have been calling in recently, and they are calling on my direct line to get information, personal information about their situations, which I'm very happy to give you. It only takes you to call me at my number 941-441-1682. And that's my number in Sarasota, Florida. And it comes straight over to me wherever I may be in Southeast Asia. Again, the number is 941-441-1682. Okay, now, the next part of my talk is going to be difficult to understand. And if you feel you need to come back and listen later when you're more alert, do so. It's actually worth it. It's really, really important for you to understand this. Don't let it just wash over you like waves in the ocean. Please make an effort here. I'm going to go right down to basics here to make sure you have the best chance to understand this. The situation in Greece boils down to the single most important issue for the financial system: collateral, also known as hard assets. You know, the house you pledge to your bank when you take out a mortgage, for example. Modern financial theory dictates that sovereign bonds are the most risk-free assets in the financial system. Inferior assets would include things like equities, municipal bonds, corporate bonds, real estate, and things like that. They are all below sovereign bonds in terms of risk profile. The reason for this is that it's far more likely for a company to go belly up than an entire country. Because of this, the entire Western financial system has sovereign bonds, such as US Treasuries, German Bunds, Japanese sovereign bonds, etc., as the senior most asset pledged as collateral for hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of trades. Indeed, the global derivatives market is roughly $700 trillion in size. Now that's over 10 times the world's GDP. And sovereign bonds, including even bonds from bankrupt countries such as Greece, are one of, if not the primary collateral, underlying all of these trades. Lost amidst the hubbub about austerity measures and debt-to-GDP ratios for Greece is the real issue that concerns the European Union banks and the European Union regulators. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the major overriding question that must be asked here, so listen carefully. Here it is. What happens to the trades that European Union banks have made using Greek sovereign bonds as collateral? Let me repeat that. What happens to the trades that European Union banks have made using Greek sovereign bonds as collateral? Because, heaven help us, there is no answer to that question. Absolutely no answer. Dead silence. Now you can take my word for this. This story has been completely ignored in the media. But if you read between the lines, you will begin to understand what really happened during the previous Greek bailouts. Remember two things. One, before the second Greek bailout, the European Central Bank swapped out all of its Greek sovereign bonds for new bonds that would not take a haircut. Two, some 80% of the bailout money went to European Union banks that were Greek bondholders, not the Greek economy. Regarding number one, going into the second Greek bailout, the European Central Bank has been allowing European nations and banks to dump sovereign bonds onto its balance sheet in exchange for cash. This occurred via two schemes called LTRO1 and LTRO2, which happened in December 2011 and February 2012, respectively. Collectively, these moves resulted in European Union financial entities and nations dumping over 1 trillion euros in sovereign bonds onto the European Central Bank's balance sheet. Quite a bit of this was Greek debt, as everyone in Europe knew that Greece was totally bankrupt. So when the ECB, or the European Central Bank, swapped out its Greek bonds for new bonds that would not take a haircut during the second Greek bailout, the ECB was making sure that the Greek bonds on its balance sheet remained untouchable, and as a result, could still stand as high-grade collateral for the banks that had lent them to the ECB. So the ECB effectively allowed those banks that had dumped Greek sovereign bonds onto its balance sheet to avoid taking a loss and not have to put up new collateral on their trade portfolios. Which brings us to the other issue surrounding the second Greek bailout. The fact that 80% of the money went to European Union banks that were Greek bondholders instead of the Greek economy. Here again, the issue was about giving money to the banks that were using Greek bonds as collateral to ensure that they had enough capital on hand. Piecing this together, it's clear that the Greek situation actually had nothing to do with helping Greece. Forget about Greece's debt issues or protests or even the political decisions. The real story was that the bailouts were all about ensuring that the European Union banks that were using Greek bonds as collateral were kept whole by any means possible. This is why the current negotiations in Greece boil down to one argument, whether or not it will involve an actual restructuring of Greek debt that will affect bondholders across the board. Greece wants this. The ECB and EU leaders don't, for the obvious reasons that any haircut of Greek debt that occurs across the board will have two major consequences. One, implode a small but significant amount of European Union bank derivative trades. 2, be immediately followed by Spain, Italy, and ultimately France, asking for similar deals. At which point, you're talking about over $3 trillion in high-grade collateral being restructured, and this is collateral that is likely backstopping well over $30 trillion in derivative trades at the large European Union banks. Remember, EU banks as a whole are leveraged at 26 to 1. At these leverage levels, even a 4% drop in asset prices wipes out all of your capital. And any haircut of Greek, Spanish, Italian, and French debt would be a lot more than 4%. The next round of the great crisis is very close. The ECB bought 2 years of time with its pledge to do whatever it takes, but the global bond bubble is still going to burst, and when it does, it's going to make 2008 look like a Sunday afternoon picnic without ants. This is what the Greek people voted for. No, they didn't vote to stay in the euro. They voted for the party that said it would reduce the debt and meet pension obligations. The Greek people and voters are not stupid. They knew this could only happen by either the rest of Europe bailing out Greece again or by leaving the euro. The Greek people know perfectly well that Europe is not going to bail them out, because to do so will only set everyone up for the next bailout. The Greek people and the rest of Europe know full well that the debt will never be repaid, and that the Troika are now acting as nothing better than the enforcers of loan sharks. Syriza knows that it had 6 months before the voters would throw them out, and once out, Syriza would never come back. The Greeks needed to show good faith in actually attempting to negotiate a resolution with the Troika. This has now been done and is failing. The demand for reparations from Germany is designed not to actually extract the reparations, but to anger the Germans to the point that they will block any compromise that Syriza would have been required to accept. The Greek government was elected by a battered and exploited Greek people, and it's been establishing the conditions that will give them the moral high ground in the eyes of their voters, which was actually needed to leave the euro. Having set the conditions, when will it happen? I'm going to go out on a limb and guess May the 9th. Greece will leave the euro, and they'll do it sooner rather than later. They've made the April payment, but they simply don't have the money for the May or June payments, and they cannot pass legislation required by Europe and the Germans and stay in power. This gives us a late May or June date, but I think it'll be earlier. Capital flight will press the issue. Imposing currency controls will be a fundamental element of any Greek exit. Accounts will be frozen, and any money in accounts will be redenominated in new drachmas. Once the bank accounts are unfrozen, the residual former euros will now be worth whatever the new drachma has dropped to. The drop will be massive, overcorrecting to the downside. Once it is accepted that the Greek exit is coming, and there will be no last-minute deal, and with memories of Cyprus too fresh in Greece's mind, the money will flow out of the country. not just corporate money, most of which is probably offshore already, but any remaining personal money in bank accounts. So Greece has to move before the coming exit is perceived as inevitable and the money starts to flow out. When the Greek exit happens, it will be during the weekend. The banks will be closed, Parliament will be called into emergency session, and a packet of laws will be passed. As this needs to be done on a Saturday, to avoid a weekday wholesale capital flight the moment that Parliament is called into session, this leaves only a few possible dates. And where there are few possible dates, I'm looking at the earlier date, so earlier in May. And looking at the calendar, that leaves us with May the 2nd, 9th, or 16th. My own guess is that the 2nd is too soon and the 16th is too late. That leaves me guessing May the 9th. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I warned you this would be difficult, and it was. So if you feel that you are so inclined, you can always listen to it again. It took me a while to put it all together, so I hope and feel that I've done service to the most simple explanation that I could give you. And I think you might find it comes together more succinctly with a second listen. So anyway, it's up to you. I hope and think I prepared you for what is coming so that you will be in an elevated position of knowledge and understanding when the headlines are screaming blue murder and the markets are collapsing. All right. Well, on March the 16th, 1936, the government of the United States published the very first edition of the Federal Register. President Roosevelt had been taking a lot of heat over the previous year. Under his New Deal program, dozens of government agencies were passing new rules, regulations, and codes at an extremely feverish pace. It became impossible for anyone to keep track of them, even the other agencies within the government. So in the summer of 1935, they created a new law requiring every executive agency to publish a daily official record of their activities. This official record was called the Federal Register, and it would contain a complete set of every rule, regulation, code, and proposal issued by each of the executive agencies. The first edition was published on March the 16th, 1936. It was all of 16 pages. Every single workday since then, without fail, the government has published the Federal Register. Its first full year, 1937, contained a total of 3,450 pages. By 1942, the Federal Register had grown to over 10,000 pages. It passed 20,000 for the first time in 1967. More than 30,000 in 1973, and more than 40,000 the following year in 1974. The Federal Register exploded during the 1970s, in fact, touching nearly 90,000 pages by the end of the Carter administration. During Reagan's time, the publication shrank to under 50,000, only to rise again under subsequent presidents. The longest edition ever published was logged at 6,653 pages in a single day during Bush the Second's administration. President Obama has averaged nearly 80,000 pages per year, far and away the highest of any president in U.S. history. This morning's edition, in fact, is a whopping 358 pages full of new rules, regulations, and proposals. Did you read it?
Neither did I.
But as the old saying goes, ignorance of the law is not an excuse. To add an addendum to my Rome versus US comparison the other day, under Diocletian's reign, the Roman Empire's body of laws and regulations multiplied like rabbits. He centralized all aspects of the economy, controlling wages, prices, commerce, and agricultural activity. Violations in many cases were subject to the death penalty. And when people complained, he told them that the barbarians were at the gate and that individual liberty needed to be sacrificed for the greater good of security. By Diocletian's time, Rome was already bankrupt. His regulations pushed the empire over the edge. It's not much different today. Each and every one of these obscure regulations costs money. So it's not surprising that as the number of pages in the Federal Register has increased, so has the U.S. federal debt. In order to pay for all this bureaucracy, every citizen has become subject to an increasingly complex and punitive tax system enforced at the point of a gun by a bankrupt government desperate to keep the party going. Well, Europe is surely at the top of the heap among today's raging financial market lunacy. European bond prices are going up because European bond prices are going up. It's an utterly irrational, speculative mania that would do the Dutch tulip bulb punters proud. Does Mario Draghi, the head of the ECB, have a clue that he is destroying price discovery completely? Do the purported adults that run the ECB not see that the entire $20 trillion European bond market is flying blind without any heed to honest price signals and risk considerations at all? Never before has an agency of the state so boldly promised speculators literally trillions in windfall gains by the simple act of buying today what Draghi promises he will be buying himself tomorrow. In fact, European financial markets are being stampeded by a herd of front runners who listened to Draghi again last week reassure them that come hell or high water, the ECB will buy every qualifying bond in sight at a rate of $65 billion per month until September 2016. Period. And there will be some tomorrow, as more and more sovereign debt sinks into the netherworld of negative yield and falls below the ECB's floor, minus 0.2%, there will be less supply eligible for purchase from among the outstanding debt of each nation in the ECB's capital key. Ladies and gentlemen, this is price fixing with a vengeance. But here's the thing. The geniuses at the ECB are not cornering the market. They are being cornered by the speculators who are recklessly front-running the central bank with their finger on the sell button. Everything in the European fixed income market is now so wildly overpriced and disconnected from reality that the clueless fools in Frankfurt dare not stop. They dare not even evince a nuance of a doubt. So this is a house of cards like no other. With Greece a hair from the ejection seat, everything is priced as if there is no redenomination risk. Likewise, with the European economies still dead in the water, and notwithstanding some short-term data squiggles in the sub-basement of historic trends, the debt of Europe's mostly bankrupt states is priced as if there is no credit risk anywhere on the continent outside Greece. After all, consider three fundamentals that scream out danger ahead. Namely, public debt ratios continue to rise, GDP continues to flatline, and the Eurozone superstate in Brussels continues to kick the can and bury its member states in bailout commitments that would instantly result in political insurrection in Germany, France, and every other major European polity were they ever to be called. In short, Europe is a financial and political powder keg. The ECB is bluffing a $20 trillion debt market, and the Brussels apparatchiks are bluffing 300 million voters. The only problem is that the true facts of life are so blindly obvious that it's only a matter of time before these bluffs are called. And then the furies will break loose. So with no growth and rising debt, how long can the Brussels bureaucrats continue to bluff? So yes, the euro and the eurozone do not have a prayer of surviving. It's only a question of when the bluff of a handful of bureaucrats in Brussels and Frankfurt is called. Maybe the Greek finance minister Varoufakis will do it next week, or his successor will be forced to after the next Greek election. But whatever the precise scenario, Greece is finished. The bailout commitments will be called, and all hell will break loose in a $20 trillion bond market that is in thrall to a raging central bank-induced mania. In this fraught context, it is tempting to think that Mario Draghi is being paid off by someone. But a project this monumentally stupid may be just that, to wit, the work of a monumentally stupid man. Well, 70 years ago, the United States of America had just emerged from World War II as the most dominant superpower in the world. At that point, America's economy was the only one left standing. And the U.S. government had essentially dictated terms in establishing a new global financial system, known as the Bretton Woods Agreement, and doing so thrust the dollar at the center of world trade and banking. Suddenly, every government, central bank, and major corporation needed to hold and transact U.S. dollars and to establish a banking relationship in the United States. This gave the United States a tremendous amount of power, power they respected and never abused. At the same time, high-ranking members of the Nazi Party had fled to the four corners of the world, often with a vast treasure trove stashed away at Swiss banks. Most of this wealth was acquired through mass genocide. And yet, Switzerland's secrecy laws protected Nazi clients from having their information turned over to authorities. No one pressed the issue further. Think about it. The U.S. government could have done something. They had the power back then. They could have punished Switzerland with all sorts of banking and financial penalties. They could have threatened to kick them out of the financial system itself. But they didn't. Instead, in 1945, the U.S. government gave the Nazis a pass. This is extraordinary when you think about it. Because if you fast forward several decades, We see now that the US government is chasing people to the ends of the earth. Even more, they've brought the full extent of their financial resources to bear against entire banking systems, including Switzerland's. They've successfully shuttered some of the oldest banks in the world, imprisoned foreign bank executives, and even got foreign governments to change their laws. So who exactly are the nefarious criminal terrorists that Uncle Sam is spending so much effort to chase down? Americans. Specifically, Americans who have failed to file administrative paperwork with the IRS to declare overseas financial accounts. There are countless stories out there of people having their life savings confiscated by the government because they didn't file a disclosure form, even if there are no back taxes due. Certainly, there is some meaningful percentage of these people who have been hiding undeclared income overseas, hoping never to pay tax on it. And it's important to acknowledge that. But while this sort of behavior had been going on for decades, it took until 2010 for the U.S. government to pass the Foreign Account Tax Compliant Act, FATCA, establishing the power to bully global financial institutions into compliance. The reason is obvious. The United States government is broke. Decades ago, the future was bright, and they could afford to give even the Nazis a pass. They didn't really need the money, and it wasn't worth abusing the tremendous financial power that they had been entrusted with. But today, every penny matters. The U.S. government is in a position where they have to borrow money just to pay interest on the money they've already borrowed. Their own internal numbers estimate their net worth at minus $60 trillion, which includes their own estimates of long-term Social Security liabilities. So they have no qualms about abusing the trust that the rest of the world has given them, or even creating new powers out of thin air through the most destructive legislation imaginable. It's often said that there are only a few times in a person's life when you can really see what someone's character is made of. Typically, times of extreme adversity, such as being near death or flat broke. That's where the U.S. government is right now, enabling us now to see its true character. This is not a government of the people, for the people, and by the people. It is a government that takes from the people by any means necessary. And they grow bolder by the day. Well, investors incredibly are placing their capital in yet another financial instrument which is guaranteed to lose money, Australian government debt. 47 investors participated in the Australian government's $200 million bond tender. The participants typically bid the amount they're willing to pay, and the highest bids win the auction. In this case, and for the first time in Australia, every single one of the 47 bidders offered a price so high that it implies a negative interest rate. Even the lowest bid in the auction implied a net loss, or an effective yield of negative 0.015%. The highest price implied a yield of negative 0.085%. What's really bizarre is that this particular issue was for inflation-linked bonds, which means that if the government's official monkey math shows that inflation is falling, the yield could actually become even more negative. Insane? Of course. But here's the thing. These bankers aren't investing their own money. It's not like some guy is taking his $1 million bonus and saying, hey, I think I'll go and buy some government debt that guarantees I'll lose money. No, he buys a Maserati. Then he picks up his garbage debt with his customers' money. Not only is this idiotic, it's borderline criminal. At a minimum, it's seriously unethical. Banks and other money managers have a solemn obligation, a fiduciary responsibility that comes with the sacred charge of safeguarding other people's money. Back in the 1500s, Renaissance-era merchant bankers risked their own capital alongside their customers, doing meaningful deals that financed exploration and the expansion of world trade. Now it's all about commissions, obtuse regulations, and following the latest banking fad. This is officially now the latest banking fad, buying government bonds at negative yields. You'll remember a few years ago when the latest banking fad was handing out no-money-down mortgages to dead people and unemployed bus drivers, or buying AAA-rated bonds which pooled these subprime loans together? That didn't exactly work out so well, did it? Well, neither will this. In fact, there are plenty of similarities between today's negative interest rates and the early 2000s housing bubble. Back then, banks were essentially paying people to borrow money. They offered the least creditworthy borrowers absurd amounts of money, which sometimes even exceeded the purchase price of the home they were buying. Remember, 102% loans were not uncommon back then, which financed the entire purchase along with the extra closing costs. We even saw 105% loans, which allowed a little bit extra to make home improvements. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that it's criminally stupid to pay someone to borrow money. Yet that's exactly what's happening now. Instead of people, though, it's governments who are effectively being paid to borrow. We all remember last time how much this impacted the global financial system. Everyone believed that it would all work out okay. Then one day, it didn't. Lehman Brothers went bust, and the entire banking system started to collapse. There's very little difference between then and now, and very little reason to expect a different outcome. Only a fool believes that this time it's different. All right, well, I have another reminder from Johnny Miller about his excellent seminar in Guatemala that will teach you about the logistics of life in a foreign country and actually is to be highly recommended. We're less than, this is what he says, and I will just read it out for you. We're less than 3 months away from my next Boots on the Ground seminar in Central America. It will begin Saturday, July the 11th, and run through Thursday, July the 16th, 2015. Why should you come down? There are many good reasons, not the least of which is that serious expats know boots-on-the-ground experience is the best way to see how inexpensive and excellent life can be in Latin America. You can't really see expat life in Latin America on a soft, packaged, prefab, sun-and-fun weekend deal to Costa Rica or Cancun. Join our private little group and don't miss the chance to get your boots on the ground. You'll find out for yourself why so many seminar attendees make plans, come down, and never look back. Go to www.expatwisdom.com and click on the Latin America seminar link for full details. Note, there is an early bird $500 per person discount if you sign up before May the 1st. So let me give you that website once again, www.expatwisdom.com. expatwisdom, that's all one word, expatwisdom.com. And you will find a link called Latin American Seminar. You will want to click it. Well, with the news that Clinton has decided to run for office, you really have to wonder how it is that such a diversified society, with such an abundance of opinions throughout such a vast land, the Democratic Party is unable to find anyone outside of the core political machine willing to even take a stab at becoming the chief public servant. America is supposed to be a self-governed democracy. It has destroyed the entire Middle East over the past 15 years in the name of self-governance and rule by the people, for the people. What a farce. How can anyone in that country say with a straight face that America is a nation ruled by the people, for the people, when the system is so locked down to anyone outside of the elite political insiders that it cannot even find a few tokens to throw at the facade of democracy at work? Well, a recent analysis from Avalia Health demonstrates why the enrollment push may have peaked. The percentage of eligible Americans signing up drops off significantly as income rises and federal subsidies phase out, suggesting that absent subsidies, Americans find the exchange insurance products unaffordable or of little value. And if the carrot of federal subsidies has not resulted in expected enrollment, the stick, or the mandate to purchase insurance, seems even less effective. The special open enrollment period to accompany this year's tax filing season has resulted in a 36,000 sign-up in the 37 states using healthcare.gov. But 4 million to 6 million people are simply expected to pay the mandated tax. Well, here's an email from Corey O'Sheen. You, sir, crack me up. You could say, I had chicken soup for lunch and it would sound like the world is coming to an end. Sadly, I believe what you say. The figures you present are amazing along with your analysis. I cannot find any profit motive you have, so I tend to trust you more than others I listen to. Thank you for the time you spend on your show and informing people. Thank you, in caps. You have helped me make decisions that I hope will be stupid, sold my IRA, but probably will not be. I take responsibility for my own actions and decisions should the world not end. Not sure where you stand on the spiritual stuff, but I am a man of faith. I tried to tune into Dr. Michio's Science Fantastic. Darn, there was some English dude speaking. Whoa, he's interesting. Who is this guy? Richard Martin, wake up call. That electronic mishap has never happened before or since. God works in mysterious ways. Keep up the good work. Thanks again, Corey O. Oh, thank you, Corey O. That was most cordial of you, and I do appreciate it. Let's try an email from Kevin Sierra, which reads as follows. Richard, your April the 10th discussion on the AIIB and Shanghai physical metals markets was very interesting. You mentioned that as China has large amounts of physical gold on hand, the price of gold will soon be set in China, which may or may not result in the price of gold rising. You also mentioned that the new AIIB gives the world an alternative payments system to the US-controlled SWIFT system. As for the new clearing system, The new clearing system will probably settle mostly in dollars in the beginning, with more and more being settled in yuan as the time goes on. The message I see in all this is that the day of the US dollar dominance is soon coming to an end. Which leads to my question. As a person with all his savings in dollars, what does this mean to me? For now, parking savings in US T-bills seems safe enough, but how long will that last? If there was a Chinese yuan T-bill, that might be a good alternative, but that option doesn't seem to exist yet. For now, I will sit tight, I guess, and see what happens. Best regards, Kevin Ciara. Well, Kevin, we must take it bit by bit, day by day, and try to see as far ahead as we possibly can. And I really do think that for the time being, you're right. And whatever clearing system exists, it will, in the main, be using US dollars for the foreseeable future, but with a very definite trend towards the Chinese currency as time goes by. I think that you can still keep your US Treasury bills. Don't buy anything else for the time being. This is a period of deflation. Assets will fall in value, and your T-bills will maintain their value for however long that may happen to be, which may not be too long, but certainly long enough to give us a very good guide, excellent amounts of warning as to when the system might implode. And by that, just take a look at Greece. See how much warning we have there. Plenty of warning. Anybody with money in Greece needs their heads examined. But in the end, Greece will implode, and everybody hopefully will have their money out of Greece, and frankly, life will go on. Greece will do much better in the drachma than it ever would have done in the euro. People will come to Greece for their holidays. They'll find it cheaper and cheaper, and Greece will eventually slowly climb out of its terrible situation in which it finds itself today. So no worries from that point of view. Just be sure to keep your money liquid, preferably in US dollars for the time being, and then everything will be just hunky-dory. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, I feel we've come to the end of our show, and I will just finish off with one rather interesting anecdote that I came across the other day. In what seems to be a kind of compensating behavior, when heterosexual men see another man they perceive as being more attractive than themselves, they try to increase their wealth. They make high-risk, high-return decisions, says Eugene Chan from the University of Technology, Sydney in Australia. He did four behavioral experiments involving 820 men and women. After being shown pictures of attractive men, the heterosexual men in the study were more likely to choose a riskier bet when given the choice than at other times or than when shown a picture of an attractive woman. In one experiment, some men were shown male models in Abercrombie and Fitch advertisements, while others were shown female Victoria's Secret models. A third group were shown photographs of average-looking people. The participants were then offered the choice of getting $100 or taking a bet where they had a 90% chance of getting nothing and a 10% of chance of getting $1,000. The men who saw male models were more likely to choose the risky bet than the men who were shown female models or mere mortals. And no difference was seen in their behavior of the women. The effect was greater in participants who rated the models as more attractive than themselves, suggesting the risk-taking was an attempt to compensate for perceived inferiority. And there was a bigger effect when the men were in a mating mindset, imagining wooing a woman. Quoting Chan, "This financial risk-taking occurs because men want to appear more desirable to women, and having more money is one way to do so. Taking financial risks is one quick way to get more money, even if it might not be a sure thing." End of quote. Bill von Hippel of the University of Queensland in Australia says the results highlight an aspect of male mating behaviour that people tend to forget. Before attracting females, the men need to compete with other males for access to them, he says. All right, everybody. Take care. See you at the end of the week. Bye-bye.